So we have a special treat, and we apologize for the short notice, but we just found out that Professor King would be here, and it's a great pleasure for me to welcome back to AAAS Sir David King. Dr. King is the director of the Smith School of Enterprise and Environment at the University of Oxford. Most people know him because he served between 2000 and 2007 as the science advisor, the chief scientific advisor to the UK government, head of the government office of science, where he had an extremely distinguished record on every major science-related issue facing humankind. And you could go through all of them in a broad array, but he was involved in climate change issues, in developing an energy technologies institute, dealing with things like bird flu, and an extremely diverse array. Most of us know he was quite close to Tony Blair, who actually followed his advice on a regular basis, a characteristic not necessarily true of either heads of government or science advisors and their relationships with him. He was involved in the government science and innovation strategy, but one of the things that came up actually in a recent meeting that we jointly held with the joint research centers of the European Commission was Dr. King's idea of a foresight project that in fact is being emulated in a variety of places around the country. So since he left government service, he's had a very interesting career. In fact, he's gone back to academia as the director of the Smith School. He's maintained a research lab at the University of Cambridge, where he had a distinguished academic career before moving into the government. But he also has some other interesting titles and activities. He's the president of the Collegio Carlo Alberto in Turin, which is a sister institution to the Smith School at Oxford. He's also senior science advisor to UBS. He's science advisor to President Kagame of Rwanda and does a variety of other activities, particularly with the commissioners in the European Commission who are involved in capacity building around the world. So this is somebody who understands science and policy from every dimension of it, whether it's at the national level, the international level, or a truly global level. It's a great pleasure to have Sir David with us.
Thank you very much, Alan, and delighted to be back here, and thank you, audience, for turning up at such short notice. I'm going to be really focusing on quite a number of lessons that I learnt gradually of my 7-8 years in government and working subsequently, as you said, with the European commissioners, working in Africa. It has struck me that we have in front of us in the 21st century a qualitatively different challenge than any challenge we had in the previous century. And so what I want to do is just present this to you and have this opportunity to get some response. The 20th century I'm going to characterize as a century of enormous success. We could even go back to the 19th century. The delivery from civil engineering through science, mathematics, medicine, agriculture, technology, driving the transformation of our societies into this modern mode that we have now. I would also give some credit to the economic and political developments that accompanied that. And we can measure the success of all of that in terms of human lifespan. Human lifespan, our expected lifespan at the beginning of the 20th century for the 1.5 billion people on the planet was around 40, 45, between 40 and 45. And by the end of the century, we had pushed that up to approaching 80. And interesting question, there's no sign of an asymptote. The anticipated lifespan is still increasing linearly with time. And so we have this wonderful success story, and I'm now going to suggest that, and it's going to produce a hangover, and he's already developing that for the 21st century. And the hangover comes from the other side of that. Our life expectancy going up means many more people were living into maturity. And population dynamics very simply means that if more people are living into maturity in a society, they will form breeding pairs, and breeding pairs breed, and so population explodes. Now the dynamics, and I was chatting to Norman Neureiter beforehand, let me repeat what I said if you don't mind. The dynamics is actually relatively simple. Country by country, there's a fairly general rule that emerges. And that is that you get, let's just take Britain, Middle Ages, on average a woman had 7 or 8 children, on average. Of those, 2 survived into maturity on average. And so, since 2.1 is the figure required to give a stable population, virtually the British population was stable for hundreds of years. And then come the civil engineers. Some people say also then came tea. The British and the Dutch became the big tea drinking nations following the Chinese, and there's some evidence that lifespan went up with tea drinking. The phenolic character of tea has a lot to do with human well-being, but also the fact that drinking water that had been boiled and then treated with this phenolic substance was a good way to manage the same problem that the civil engineers were managing. So tea, civil engineering, and we get a sudden increase in lifespan, and those women are caught out. Suddenly all 7 children are surviving into maturity, and they're having big families. And it turns out it takes women 2 generations to learn what's happening. So in the second generation, they're doing the same as their mothers and having 7 or 8 children, but in the third generation, the number crashes down to 2. So in effect, women seem to know intuitively, according to population dynamics, how many children to have so that 2 live into maturity, and we're back into that situation in Britain now. For years it's been about 2, it's now 1.9. Now of course in some countries the figure goes below, and in Japan, in Italy, in Portugal, in Spain, interesting, Catholic countries dominantly, figure is 1.2. It means there are big population problems there in terms of an aging population. So we have this dynamic operating, which means that the population started increasing by 1 billion every 12 years. That was at the fastest rate through the second half of the 20th century, and we reached the end of the century at 6 billion. We're now 6.75, we're going to pass 8 billion in about 2028, and we'll almost certainly reach 9 billion by mid-century. Everything I'm talking about now is going to be related to this fact. This is what is qualitatively different in terms of our challenge. Let me just, before developing that, say a few more words. Oh, so I've just killed it. That wasn't clever. No? There we go. I'll say a little bit about this school that I've established at the end of it all, but let me just come to human lifespan. So let me just correct what I've said. On average, approaching 80 now, but let's have a look around the world, and you'll see there in the middle of my world scene is Africa, and red and dark red imply a life expectancy of less than 60. The dark red, the orange or red, if you can tell the difference, is less than 50. So there's a part of the world that hasn't actually achieved the benefits of what we've just been discussing, and that obviously is an issue that we need to take on board. But if you then, for example, take India, a country that's highly populated, heavily populated, and life expectancy in India is over 60 today. Take South America, and in terms of what I was saying, female fecundity was about 5-30 years ago in South America as a whole, and now it's plummeted down to 2.2. We've passed the two generations, and we're into that third generation where well-being has gone up. So the South American population, you see life expectancy in a big yellow area there, is now over 70, has well passed that peak of the population growth point. There's the best projection for population going through this century. So starting the century at 6 billion, projected forward to 2100 at 8.5 billion with a peak on the median curve at about 9 billion. So the population dynamics there is this self-restraining growth as we see an improvement in well-being, as we see an improvement in fresh water conditions, hygienic conditions, and so on. Now, 9 billion people is a very big challenge. Basically, today, we are using the natural resources of the planet at a rate faster than they're being replenished. And we are mismanaging another set of natural resources. And I can just summarize the other set of natural resources in terms of the three of the Greek elements. It's the earth, the land, it's the air, and it's the sea. We are mismanaging each of those sets of commons at a tremendous rate. And so it's that sense, that notion of mismanagement. The economists, I think, like to call these market failures. Normally, when there's a failure in your predictions from your model, you would say there's something wrong with the model, but these are apparently market failures. So you can introduce market mechanisms to cope with them. Fine. But we haven't managed to do that very successfully. I'll indicate later where I think we are being successful, but the challenges now are so massive. The real question is whether humanity has the savvy at this point to begin to do a better job in managing them. People say to me, but isn't there something we can do about this? Can't we halt population growth at 7 billion? Now, of course, the children have already been born who will want to have children, who will take that curve all the way to this median curve here. If you want to know where the 0.025 probability fractal is, that's predicting forward based on disease suddenly spreading. So I don't think there's a simple way to cope with this, but I would say the most effective ways of bringing population growth under control, apart from the Chinese directive method, thou shalt not have more than one child per family, unless they are twins. Apart from that, it's female education and female empowerment that clearly has the greatest result in terms of managing population growth. And the second part of that is very important, female empowerment and, of course, the availability of contraceptives. So here's the kernel of my talk. This carousel, I have spoken about it before, it's coming to be known as the King Carousel. This carousel then says population is the driver, the challenge that we are faced with, and these are the sets of challenges that I'm suggesting we need to focus our attention on. Now, would that we could take on board each of these challenges one by one, regardless of the others? And the problem with this curve is that it's actually a many-body problem. Right? If I take water resource, if you go to Australia, where the impacts of climate change are already playing through in the southern parts of Australia, where desertification is creeping up, you'll see that in the states of Victoria and South Australia, they have had now 9 successive drought years. The farmers are packing their bags. They have been farming the non-saline aquifers, the freshwater aquifers, far faster than the rainfall has been replenishing them. And so the idea that owning land also meant you owned water, which is very strong in South Australia, is now disappearing because they have overused the freshwater. State of Victoria, as we stand today, one third of the fresh water that you will get in the cities and towns, Melbourne and other towns in the state of Victoria, is now from desalination plants. Right? This is not used for farming. Obviously, that is not a financially viable way forward. Now, you could say, well, in the AAAS, you'd be very pleased. Here's science and technology providing the solution. But the problem is that desalination is a very energy-intensive process, and of course, most of the electricity in the state that is used for these processes is produced from coal-fired power stations. So in effect, they're burning coal to desalinate water and produce it as fresh. Now, you could say that's also an energy problem, but of course I'm referring to the fact that burning the coal is producing carbon dioxide that causes the climate change that they're trying to manage by desalination. If I don't want to appear to be arguing for a world government to manage these problems, but if I was science advisor to the president of the world government, I would say ban all desalination plants that aren't driven by solar energy. Everywhere where you need desalination, there turns out there's plenty of sunshine. So, we haven't driven that technology through. So what I'm pointing out here is that for the science and technology community, this process we're discussing now, every bit of it involves a massive challenge and opportunity. There's a real innovation agenda here, innovation and wealth creation agenda in managing these problems. And we simply need to grasp them in their full round if we're going to deal with them. Let me take one or two others. Health and development, since I won't say much more about health. When I was in government, we did a futures program on detection and identification of disease. The reason I took that on board was because my baptism in my position in government was the foot and mouth disease epidemic in Britain in 2001, which was the biggest foot and mouth disease epidemic any country had had. On the top of my wish list when I was operating that and trying to bring it under control, I mean, we did this with computer programs and we introduced an entirely new control procedure as the epidemic was moving on, and that control procedure involved moving quickly onto animals that had the disease. So what I would like to have had was a small detector that I could have issued to every farmer so that they could stick this into the orifice of an animal, I don't mind which orifice, and determine what the nature of the animal's sickness was. And if it was foot and mouth disease, call in the army to get rid of the animals instantly. Because what you've got, if you don't do that, is a virus factory in that farm. So what I then advanced to in this program on human, animal and plant infectious diseases we looked at, and we worked with about 500 scientists, medics, economists, engineers around the world on this. The big item on the wish list was an item that would look and behave just like a mobile phone, except that on the end of it would be a DNA chip that would detect perhaps 60 major threatening human diseases or animal diseases. Every mobile phone would then be required to have one. So in the event that somebody's ill, in you go with the detector on the end. And if it turns out to be H5N1 and you're somewhere in the world, there's a little button on this machine that I want to have that pings it through using the satellite to Geneva, and it pops up on that big map that they have in the WHO on the wall. We've got a start of a human H5N1 epidemic. So again, the message I'm trying to get through to you is that science and technology addressing these questions could come up with solutions with massive power for reducing risk to both the human and the animal population. Our estimate is that the foot and mouth disease epidemic in Britain of 2001 cost the country about £7 billion. We ran computer programs, so I was able to rerun it by putting in such a machine and saying, right, let's suppose every farmer's got one and we simply move in and take out the animals and then see how the epidemic spreads. We estimate it would have cost less than 100 million. Right, so the saving to the country would have been enormous. So the point here is, I suppose, that we are addressing a whole series of 20th century derived problems and not really focusing on the big challenges of the 21st century. If H5N1 develops, and I know it's a low probability, but the impact if it does this, if it develops into a human virus, if it can transfer human to human, our estimates were, first of all, that it would take about 3 months, wherever we inserted it into our models in the world, it would take 3 months to be totally global. That's because of the way we travel around the world in aeroplanes. So we fly around the world, and in that awful period, an epidemic spreads through silent spread, that horrible phrase, because you're unaware of the fact you're ill, you get on the plane, you're developing the virus, but you're not yet showing any symptoms, and the content in your blood is too low. Right, so you're traveling around, you arrive and you spread it. And the estimate for Britain is quite terrifying. 3 months after that, we would be potentially losing 500,000 or 1 million people out of a population of 60 million. Now, that is a high fatality rate, but of course now imagine what happens to the economy of Britain and the rest of the world, because this would be happening everywhere. So we would have a global collapsing economic system. You cannot expect somebody who works in a checkout at a supermarket to go to work with thousands of people walking past them every day. So supermarkets close down. You can just extend that model to what would happen globally. Now again, if we had this detector device, and I'm focusing on this because I think it could be used in a way that could almost halt the epidemic. You detect it somewhere in the world, ping the information through, antivirals are poured into that part of the world to attempt to dampen the potential epidemic. The issue then I want to raise is food production. Not only are we moving up to 9 billion people, but of course we don't expect that the current financial crisis will continue forever. And so we think we're going to get back into exponential GDP growth, 2-3% per annum globally. And this means that people are going to be wanting to consume more. So if you add in that exponential growth to the less than linear growth of the population, you have big consumer demand increases. Estimate for food by 2030, we will need to have globally about 50% more plant crops productive around the world to meet this growing demand that we can anticipate. So there's a nice challenge. Now we could do that with modern science and technology. I do believe we can deliver that, and the demand will be there, that's fine. But at the same time, what about the ecosystem services? We have a planetary system in which we have co-evolved with green matter, with the atmosphere, with the geological systems, and so it turns out that because we've co-evolved with these things, we're in balance. But if we create a real imbalance, there are risks that the ecosystem services that we, our life systems, depend on become eroded. So as we look at land use, we have to be very, very careful. In other words, I'm not arguing, though I might, for the mountain gorillas in Rwanda. I'm actually arguing for what the ecosystem services deliver for human beings. Right, so although I like them, Romain, but that is not the point of my argument. And so if we simply go hell for leather on food production and our cities are growing because of our population growth, we have a problem with ecosystems. Water resource, of course, water and food production, we need quite simply more crop per drop. Right, so we've got to get very clever about how we deliver water when we're irrigating plants for crop production. All of these things, again, point to a demand for scientists to come through with smart answers. And we need to oversee these to see that we don't get negative interactions around all of this. Minerals. We can estimate that perhaps the amount of copper within the top 1 kilometer of the Earth's crust is enough to keep us going for the next million years. But if you then look at what's available commercially at, say, 3-4 times the present price of copper, you've only got about 60 years of copper left at the present rate. The second part of that problem is, and where is the copper? There's no copper in China. There's no copper in Europe. Europe historically has therefore had a big presence in Africa, where there's been a lot of copper. And now, of course, China has a big presence in Africa. And what I'm referring to here is not global resource scarcity, but scarcity as perceived by different nation states and how they will respond to managing that resource scarcity. We could discuss peak oil, so energy security and supply becomes an issue. And if, let us suppose, a nation state was to decide that its own oil had passed its peak, I can think of the United States as an example, then that country might be motivated to see that there was a friendly regime in a state which had a lot of oil. And so one response to that is to move troops in and see that you get something called regime change. Now, of course, what I'm suggesting is that if we then go down this route, moving forwards where scarce resources are managed through strong nations taking individual action, individually as nations, then we might see future historians looking back at the Iraq War and seeing that as the first of the great resource wars of the 21st century. So this, for me, is an indicator that we need to look not only to the scientific community for solutions, but we also need to look at the global governance community for better global governance procedures. So looking at our global governance procedures that we have in place at the moment, United Nations, Harry Truman, that visionary president, emerging from the end of the Second World War, deciding the League of Nations had failed, we needed to do this properly. That UN document is worth rereading. It's a stunning piece of visionary action from the leaders of the world community at that point in time. The question is, what was it intended to do? It was intended to create peace in Europe into the future. It wasn't intended to manage this set of problems here. We have added these on to the UN process, and I'm simply suggesting that the United Nations needs to be re-examined in terms of its structures if we are really going to manage to set about a resource allocation issue. Prices will be determinant, but prices together with troops could also be the determinant if we don't get this right. Let me just give some more on how these things can go seriously wrong. So here is what happened to rice prices in 2008, and you'll see that from $300 per ton, the white and broken rice prices went up towards $900 per ton over a very narrow period of time. At the moment, there are roughly 1 billion people out of the 6.7 who are at less than 50 cents a day and who are therefore suffering malnutrition and early death. When the rice prices go up like this, it impacts right across that that group of people. And so, of course, the affordability, it hits the weakest. I suspect I didn't notice in my own lifetime, my lifestyle, any change whatsoever. But there's a massive change from a very large number of people when the rice prices went up a factor of three. So it is important that we analyze what caused this this big rice price increase. And we have looked at this in our new school in Oxford, and we come to a conclusion that's rather similar to the World Bank conclusion, that there are two major contributors. One is that every year, roughly 10% of the rice crop is lost due to flooding, early flooding. You want a lot of water where you are growing rice, but you don't want it when you've just planted the seed. You want that water to come along when the plant has grown through the ground. As a matter of fact, the early plant cannot survive more than 2 or 3 days underwater. So although the paddy fields are designed to hold water, you don't want the monsoon to come early. And so then you get a big loss of rice crop. And in this particular year, there was an extra big loss of the rice crop in Asia, and this certainly pushed up the price. We estimate 30% of the price increase, roughly, plus or minus 10, is due to this flooding. A completely manageable problem. Completely manageable problem. And the reason I say that is that back in 1992, I believe, in India, it was discovered that there was a wild rice plant that was surviving the flooding in the early monsoon. And that wild rice plant can survive flooding for 3 weeks. Total flooding. It still grows right through and delivers its seed. It's not commercial. I've got a photograph somewhere in the slides and we'll show you. What you then do is use modern biotechnology, genetic markers, find out which genes are giving it the flood resistance. FR13A, they're called. And these genes can then be snipped into commercial rice, and you have then produced the rice that will withstand flooding for long periods of time. Problem solved by genetic modification. Genetic modification, because of European attitudes towards GMOs, was not acceptable to the farmers in the developing world. And GMs in most of sub-Saharan Africa have been banned. South Africa is the only part of Africa where GMOs have not been banned. The flood-resistant rice is now being developed using genetic markers but without genetic snipping. And so by that technique, in the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, commercial rice has now been produced, and I believe next year it will be commercially available. Now, this could have been available, I believe, in 1997, using GM techniques, and using the annual slow technique, even with genetic markers, into the mud up to your knees and arms, developing it by the old plant breeding techniques, they produced exactly the same product, and this can now be acceptable. So there's something quite daft about this, and what we need to understand is that social attitudes towards these modern technologies that we developed in Europe, and we developed them, let me say, as a kind of lifestyle choice. I'm given the choice between a tomato that they tell me is genetically modified and a standard tomato. I don't know much about that one. I'm suspicious I'll eat the standard one. In many African countries, you don't have that choice. What you want is a tomato, and if it's edible and it's good. And what I would say is, with proper regulation, we do know that there's not a human being who has been verifiably harmed by eating genetically modified foodstuffs, despite the very large numbers in North and South America who have eaten them. And I'm going to suggest, however, that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who have suffered malnutrition and death because these have not been made available. So we're not too smart about applying the technologies we know when we don't get it right at the science-society interface. We have to work much, much harder at getting that interface right. What is the other 70%? Well, I'm afraid the other 70% of what we conclude caused that rice price rise was the American policy towards producing biofuel from grain. So the surplus that was going onto the market of grain, and a lot of it ending up in the developing world, was now being converted into biofuel, with a massive subsidy going to farmers to manage that process. And it came through very sharply in this year, and had a very big impact. Water scarcity, this is the estimated current situation in terms of freshwater resources per capita per day, going out to 4,000 litres here, and you'll see that in red you get absolute water scarcity. One part of the world, the Gulf States, is in dire difficulties with water resource scarcities, and that is an area of the world that did, with their earlier populations, have sufficient water. So desalination has to be used in that part of the world. But there are many, many other parts of the world which are suffering, and the trend is, of course, moving to more and more countries ending up in the absolute water scarcity regime. Both population growth and the changing weather patterns from climate change are major factors there. Ah, this is the picture of the wonderful picture of I believe it's from a magazine called Science. of the IRRI Institute in the Philippines, where on the right-hand side you've got this marketable flood-resistant rice, and on the left-hand side is the same rice without the flood-resistant genes. And this is just 1 week into flooding. Right, so very, very clear indicators of what we ought to be doing as we move forward. I'm going to not insult your intelligence by reminding you that the grain we depend on is already a genetically modified plant. Right, here, of course, is the, in my view, the biggest challenge of all, because climate change is an issue that requires a collective response of all of us, of all major nations. If we have one major nation saying we're not playing ball, then of course, due to what has come to be known as carbon leakage, the rest of the world will still buy these high carbon manufactured goods from that part of the world, and we would not have solved the problem. So even if we put prohibitive prices on carbon dioxide in some parts of the world, we will have this carbon leakage problem. I'm simply showing here my admiration for the scientific community and the quality of the work that has emerged over the last 10-15 years on the science base. This is from paleoclimatology, and I would suggest that without any modelling, if you look at these curves here, you have a very, very clear conclusion. And I have no idea what the skeptics, who seem to be getting very noisy in this country, would say to this. If we go back up here, this is using option 18 as a proxy for the temperature from not ice cores, but cores taken from the ocean sediment data. And so we've got a maximum about 10, 12 degrees centigrade higher than the pre-industrial temperatures in that Pliocene transition period about 50 million years ago. And at this point, Antarctica was a subtropical forest, so below the ice cores are the remnants of the subtropical forest, and there were large mammals walking about there. Between the tropics, on the other hand, we had a largely desertified landmass and extremely hot. So real estate you'd want to buy in Antarctica if there were any human beings around at that point. It took 50 million years, this is a logarithmic plot, it took 50 million years to cool down to the sorts of temperatures where we mammals were happier over the larger land masses of the planet. And of course these oscillations, the biphasic nature of the surface temperature, set in about 3 million years ago, and these oscillations are the ice ages and warm periods. If we expand them out to the last 400,000 years, I'm stressing this because I think it is just so important that we keep the arguments clear. We have these points here as the warm periods, ice ages. The warm periods are horribly short until we get to the present warm period, which is the longest on record. And the present warm period is so far 12,000 years, which happens to be the length of our civilization, roughly. Right, so what we see is carbon dioxide levels matching surprisingly closely. If you think there's no relationship with carbon dioxide emissions, you've got a great deal of difficulty explaining these two curves here. So carbon dioxide levels then shooting up to the present 389 parts per million. There's been a slowdown in the rate of carbon dioxide emissions. 2008, 4.5% down is what we're estimating compared with business as usual expectations. 2009 will be a much bigger decrease. That's all due to the financial crisis. So at the moment, we can actually measure the GDP output of the planet by just following carbon dioxide emissions. We are very closely linked in to emissions of carbon dioxide. And the big challenge for us, of course, is to completely decouple our economic growth from emissions. The big challenge is to defossilize our economies. And that school that I've set up in Oxford is taking the knowledge base from the academic community. It's using interactions with governments, regulators, and working with private sector companies on modeling their future into a zero carbon world. And of course we're working primarily with the high carbon end of those companies. So for example, we're working with BP, we're working with Shell, we're working with Centrica. We're working with the companies where the difference really matters. And I say to Tony Haywood, CEO of BP, do you have a model for the survival of your country out to mid-century when we will have a defossilized economy? And if not, come and work with us in the Smith School and we'll help you to model it. And that is what we're now doing with BP. They are funding us to find a futures model for them. And Shell and the others are all stepping in line to come and work with us. So in other words, we in Europe have already got our intentions clear. We will have reduced our emissions by mid-century by 80% of carbon dioxide. And that means that we have to effectively defossilize our economies. It's not an unrealistic target in the sense that we have four decades. So the key in doing this, in order not to harm our economies, but to keep them growing, is to see, first of all, that we use the science, innovation, market-oriented solutions process, that is a wealth-creating process, but also that we do this while not mismanaging the process. And I mean mismanaging it at government and at private sector level. A private sector company today that gets permission from the government to build a new airport somewhere in Europe, for example, and this is happening, I would say has to think twice. Are they going to end up having built a white elephant because the community is going to move towards fast rail travel as a means of working into low carbon because of the difficulties of producing kerosene for air travel? So we're having to factor in a future of low carbon mobility in which you need to look at the mobility of goods and people together, looking at land, sea and air travel, pull the whole thing together and try and figure out what 2050 will look like. So I think the message is from this, that this very high increase since our industrialization, and of course that increase mirrors what I was saying in terms of human lifespan improvement, so I'm not knocking this. It was good that we had fossil fuels around to fire up our economies. We now need to find innovative ways of making energy, innovative ways of creating fuel efficiencies and so on. Now, I want to stress that point after I've shown this. Is it allowed here?
We close our eyes.
So my school is only just over a year old, and we were really rather pleased when we got a few papers into Nature and they put us on the cover with this cartoon. And in essence, what we did was simply calculate the amount of fossil fuels so far burnt by humanity is about 500 billion tons of carbon. And we reckon that if we burn another 500 billion tons, we will certainly exceed a temperature rise of 3 degrees centigrade. So we're simply saying, if we go to 1 trillion tons, there's not much hope for future generations. It's quite a dramatic way of presenting that. So the description I gave you of how Europe sees its future is really based around this stabilization curve here at 450 parts per million. And what we're saying is that in order to be on that curve, we need to be, you'll see that we're at about 35 billion tons of carbon dioxide emitted on the planet today. We need to bring that down to about 18 billion tons by mid-century. That's the demand. I've said to you we will be 9 billion people, so we each have 2 tons per person per annum as our quotient by mid-century. In the lead-up to Copenhagen, I've been traveling around the world and suggesting that each country should take that 2 tons per person per annum as their objective in reaching the point of mid-century. Now, Britain is currently at 10 tons per person per annum. So when I said we're going to reduce our emissions by 80%, that brings us down to the 2 tons per person per annum. That is the policy now of Europe as well. So what we're managing here is a process which is really, of course, very dramatic. We're saying we're going to be down here compared with this figure, but it's actually to be compared with the business as usual curve. Right, so the business as usual curve at 2050 is over 60 billion tons. Well, it was. I've now put the dotted line in as a result of our debt crisis. So we've redone a business as usual curve. You'll see that actually by 2020 we're estimating that the emissions will be about between 15 and 25% down as a result of this downturn in the global economy. That does depend on whether you model in an L-shaped recovery or a W-shaped recovery or whatever. We actually put in a fairly soft recovery to get that sort of figure. It has bought us a little bit of time. You see that we're not going to be far off this curve as we move forward in time. So the need to get a global agreement out of Copenhagen is urgent, but it doesn't mean it's too late. We've still got time to act. Here's a nice curve to figure to wake you up at this stage. What I am getting at with this figure is that a large number of people have produced pie charts in which they mix categories. And I think there is no shortcut to this. You have to take the engineer's view that you cannot take energy sources and mix them up with final use. Right, you have to separate out your categories. So energy sources are all down here. Global energy demand and use at the moment is 475 exajoules. That's 10 to the 18, 475 times 10 to the 18 joules. That's how much energy source we use a year. And these are the final services that we human beings get out of those energy sources, and it goes through these processes. Some of it is converted to electricity, we use engines, we have passive systems, we have carbon-intensive manufacturing processes in here, and we finally end up with these services to humanity. I'm putting up this figure wherever I go, because I'm suggesting, as we move through the next 40 years, every bit of this curve shows a place where science, innovation, wealth creation can be made. As we transit from this very high carbon world we live in to a very low carbon world, we will see all sorts of opportunities for innovation emerging. Now, here's the bit of this curve that some of you will have noticed is a bit misleading. 475 exajoules on the left-hand side is the energy input. That's not the energy output here. There are energy losses on the way. So let me just show you this again, but showing the energy losses. So the actual output of useful energy from the 475 exajoules of input energy is a total of 55 exajoules worth of work that we're getting out. Now, some of that is the Carnot cycle. Some of that is downright due to entropy. Some of that is due to heat being produced that we don't find useful. Now, a lot of that heat could be made useful. So we can't simply say that we can ignore heat losses. All of those coolers above power stations producing evaporated water means a lost opportunity in terms of combined heat and power systems. But nevertheless, if you look at this curve, a beautiful piece of work by Julian Allward and his team at Cambridge, you'll see fuel losses, generation distribution losses, there are losses in transmission. And all of this is infrastructure, and the infrastructure, changing the infrastructure to more energy efficient processes would be expensive. But if you look at the energy cost that we're putting into the left-hand side of this figure, the finance that the rest of the world puts into the Gulf states alone each year for oil is $1.7 trillion. That's just the Gulf states. Now imagine what our economies would look like if that money was being funneled into our own states for alternative ways of producing the energy that we need. So when people say to me, but these alternative energy sources are more expensive, I think you need to look at the economic model involved. At the moment, it cannot be good for the planet for this great funnel operating for finance going into the states that happen to have a large amount of this natural resource. So I am questioning most of the economic models that have been produced, including Nick Stern's models. I think they're oversimplistic. First of all, on the one hand, they are what us scientists would call ground state curves. There's no poor decisions being made by the private sector or governments in the transition. There's no investments being made which will turn out, say, can I use General Motors as an example, investing in a whole line making Humvees couldn't have been good for the economics of General Motors. Yeah, I would express that in a different way. Compare General Motors with Toyota or with BMW, with the companies that were more far-sighted into the future. How do we know how many GMs there'll be and how many Toyotas in this transition process? That's the first question I have about the economic models. Well, of course, also the economic models never showed a downturn in economies. They're all based on exponential growth into the future. But the second is, and what would the boost to our economies be if we did examine the science, innovation, wealth creation agenda arising out of not spending the money on oil, but spending it on alternatives? So I'm by no means convinced that there would be a downturn in the global economy. I think it's quite possible that we would see a stimulus in the economy if this was done correctly. Here I'm just showing off. This is our own piece of work on second generation biofuels, in which we're saying, yes, there might be biological processes, but why don't we just look at existing technologies? So we've got this process going which is based entirely on existing doable technologies. And just to let me take you around our carbon cycle, what we're saying is the input is carbon dioxide and water and fertilizer. And because this is a complete cycle, we're going to regenerate everything we input. There's some losses, but there we go. The first input is fertilizer, carbon dioxide, water, and of course sunlight. And so we're making plants, the biomass. For the plants, they are meant to be food crops. And so we're taking the carbohydrate part of the plant, the food itself, out of the process. And we're then using a digestate. Oops, we'll get this right. A digestate to take the nitrates and phosphates out of the remaining plant material. If I give you as an example a banana plant, when you take down the plant at harvesting time, roughly 5% of the mass of the plant is what you export, and the rest of the plant is left on the land to rot. It's the rest of the plant I'm now talking about. So we can turn that into nitrates and phosphates, and so this produces the cycle back into the fertilizer here. Low energy fertilizer production. So we're not going through a high-energy process, and it's therefore also a good part to the cycle. We're producing biogas from the plant material, produce syngas by catalytic partial oxidation, so that's a well-known process, and then fissiotrops to liquid fuels. Fissiotrops is the Sasol process in South Africa. They use it for converting coal to liquid fuels, but here all we're doing is taking it from syngas, and that's a very easy step. Now, these two steps have to be put into a combined chemical engineering system so the exothermic process runs the endothermic process. We have to watch the energy production of this process very carefully. The output is liquid fuels. We can produce both gasoline and kerosene. So you can run planes on this and you can run cars on this. Now, Romain Morenzi is sitting in there, and I hope he doesn't mind me mentioning Rwanda as a potential place for a technology like this to be kicked off. Rwanda is a landlocked country. The oil for Rwanda comes into Mombasa. It comes into Rwanda by trucks over a long road journey over the mountains. The direct and indirect costs are large in producing oil, getting oil into the state of Rwanda. Rwandan economy has been growing at about 10% a year for 12 years. A wonderful example of economic growth. But here's a potential problem for their economic growth. Their money is part of the $1.7 trillion going into the Gulf states for the oil, and it's all in hard-earned foreign currency from selling coffee and tea. I'm simplifying the situation, but I think that's roughly it. It's a very fertile country, a large amount of crop production. It's now virtually self-sufficient in food production. And so they're in exporting tea and coffee, and then food production locally is virtually self-sufficient. The side product here would be the fuel they need, and it could be produced, and I believe there's sufficient for them to no longer need to import oil. This could be a good place to start, because although the process is more expensive than oil, with oil at $100 a barrel, but as soon as you get beyond $100 a barrel, this becomes competitive. In Rwanda, the effective cost is, when the global cost is 70, the effective cost is more like 100. So already in Rwanda, you can see the economic benefits of doing this. Sunlight. Right, this must be the big challenge. And I just put this in front of you quickly before I move on. The red squares, as Nathan Lewis showed, if we just converted the sunlight landing on those red squares, we'd have enough to provide all the energy requirements that we need. Let's turn deserts into areas where we farm energy from the sun. Let's move on from creating solar photovoltaics out of silicon, inherently expensive, it's a high vacuum process, and move on to plastics, to paints, to ceramics. Let's use materials, glass, for these photovoltaics that every architect is happy to use on the outside of every building. In Britain, and I think I can take credit for this, we now have a building regulation in place which is rather like the car exhaust regulations that were introduced first in California. And I certainly took it from that. We simply announced a progressive regulation, and by 2017 it means that every new building that goes up in Britain has to be zero carbon in its usage. So it has to farm the energy from its environment. Whether it's geothermal or wind or whatever, it has to farm it from its environment. And of course the construction industry came to me and said, that's going to be impossible. How do we do it? And I said, well, I don't know, but you have to pay for the research and development. And if your company gets there first, then you're going to be building all the new buildings in Britain. There are now three construction companies putting up buildings today that are very close to zero carbon. However, we're keeping the screws on. By 2023, every new building in Britain will have to be from cradle to grave zero carbon. They have to produce more energy than they need in their lifetime to pay for the cost of construction and destruction as well. So these are the ways of going beyond just pricing carbon dioxide, but encouraging the innovation community to come forward with the solutions. It happened in catalysis in the back end of cars, and I can see no reason why it can't be used in a more general way. Let me just rapidly run on to this curve. This is where I would like to leave you. The Smith School in Oxford is meant to be set up as one of many future global hubs. You heard that there's now one in Italy. We would like to create a network of these hubs in which we bring together as our stakeholders, the green groups here, academe, governments, private sector, market-facing solutions is what we're all about, working, for example, the blue contains our centers, a center for private sector transformation. a Center for Catastrophic Risk Financing. This is a group of economists, engineers, physicists, philosophers, all working together, behavioral people, all working together in seeing how we can manage this. We have an in-house team of 30, but we have now 80 professors from around the university who are working with us on this. Our most ambitious center is the Climate and Development Center, which is working on a big program to set up hubs around the world. We're setting up three hubs in Africa at the moment. There'll be one in India, and then we plan to expand it beyond that. Capacity building is the key to that. Working with countries that are low carbon at the moment on economic growth models for them. The developing world hasn't got the same degree of investment that we have in all of these high carbon technologies. And I believe they therefore have some advantage to develop their economies immediately into a low carbon mode. I'm right at the end now. Let me just say, at the heart of our institute is a futures directorate. I developed the Foresight program when I was in the British government, and the idea here is to have that embedded right in the middle of what we're doing. So how will that work? Low carbon mobility. I referred to our work on second generation biofuels. We've produced a detailed report on what air, land and sea transport will look like in a decarbonized economy for the world out to mid-century. But that is actually a scoping study. Now we take that into a full futures program, 2 years of work with 100 experts drawn from around the world and producing a detailed report showing what levers governments and companies need to pull in order to optimize themselves in this wonderful challenge that we all have. So I've dwelt rather a long time at the end on climate change because I see it as the biggest challenge, but I hope you'll see that as we meet these challenges, we need to meet them in this rather holistic way so that we don't mismanage the transformation. And I don't particularly like the word management, but I do think the bottom line is we need much better global governance procedures so that we can get all these things to happen efficiently. Thank you very much.
I think we could take some questions. There's microphones on the two sides. You did agree to take some questions. Yeah, Vaughn?
Shout out, I'm Vaughn Tarikian from AAA Asset. One thing you did not mention was nuclear and dealing with desalinization and the issues like that. What is your view generally of nuclear? And it obviously touches on many of the different categories there, including security.
So I worked very hard on the International Fusion Project, ITER. I'm going to tell you that I have recently, this year, I am the only Brit who has been given the top award by the President of France. I am now a commander of the Légion d'honneur, which he assured me means that the commander in the French system is higher than the British knight. The commanders order the knights what to do, and the reason is because of my work on developing ITER, which is being built in Cadarache in France. Actually, the award was for managing Anglo-French relations through the Iraq War, because my child, ITER, was being put to one side as the relationship with France fell apart during that war. And I was the one who kept the communications open. So ITER, I clearly think, is one massive opportunity. What are the chances of success? 50%? I don't know. But it's certainly worth spending the money and the effort on that. Nuclear fission, I had to put in a report, of course, for the British government. We're in a peculiar position in Britain because we have the world's biggest standing supply of uranium. In other words, we have no need to import another gram of uranium. We could use that uranium convert into MOX with the plutonium that we have as well to get rid of it, and we would then provide 40% of all our electricity needs for about 120 years. Now, this is a no-brainer. So for Britain, we have to go straight into new nuclear build, and that's what we are doing. China is going heavily down that route, of course, and I think that it is a question simply of country by country. I have no major solution around that question. But I certainly think that it's manageable. I do think the simple principle of nuclear energy is, because it's so dangerous, it turns out that it has in practice been the safest form of energy. Right? Because we have introduced all of the measures required. So have I dealt with the question? Yeah, thank you.
Tom Wang with AAAS. You began and you ended by talking about the need for governance and more global governance. What about for the scientific community in facing challenges? Does there need to be a new way to organize how science is done, or new ways to fund how science is done to tackle many of the challenges that you talked about?
Thank you very much for that question, because it's absolutely key. My belief is that this challenge around population growth and ecosystem services, that's the way of sort of encapsulating what I'm saying. These challenges can only be met by us understanding that it requires each sector of our communities to undergo some sort of behavioral change. I'm arguing for a kind of renaissance in our thinking. How important is it that we land people on Mars? How important is it that we know about the Higgs bosons by comparison with the importance of managing this set of challenges I've just been discussing? I think we need in the scientific community to examine our priorities very carefully. I'm not suggesting that all physicists, all engineers, all chemists should now focus. That's ridiculous. But I am suggesting that when we look at very costly programs of work, we should be re-examining the basic tenets that underlie them. Now, I know that standing in the AAAS and saying that, there will be particle physicists who would want to hang me by the nearest tree. But I want simply to challenge those particle physicists to tell me why we should, after a CERN, build the next stage collision machine. There is no limit in terms of how far back you go in time, as far as I can see, in terms of energy. So we're down to, 10 to minus 10 seconds now we're looking at with the CERN. Why not go to 10 to minus 20? We can eventually build the machine going from the moon to the Earth. I can see no limit there. If there is no limit, where is the point where cost effectiveness becomes unreal in the face of these big challenges? Now, having said that, I'm delighted that the stimulus funding in this country has gone so heavily into the Department of Energy. That's exactly the right thing to do. But of course, if you talk to people in the Department of Energy, as I have today and last night, you know that after the stimulus money, there's going to be a big plunge. So how do you make that effective when it's a once-off bunch of money without follow-through?
I'm Piers Corden from AAAS in the Center for Science, Technology, and Security Policy. I don't really want to get too far into the civilian nuclear power end of things and your observation that it's a no-brainer.
No-brainer for Britain.
Oh, well, okay, but that's part of the problem if you come at it from the standpoint of global governance and what you do about places like Iran, who will say, well, you know, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. But I'm more interested in how you see the future of global governance in the context of the amounts of funds that are put into arms as opposed to arms control or nonproliferation, and whether there's any prospect from your perspective of strongly reducing the role of defense in global governance via intergovernmental agreements to do things differently. That might, of course, eventually help with the role of nuclear power, but at least at the moment, I would have to vote for other ways like solar, which you suggest could actually do everything if you put your mind to it. But I'm more interested in what you would say about sort of global governance and
however, you have challenged me on the other, so let me just quickly respond, if I may. In the British context, I was involved in setting out the plan for how Britain could possibly reduce its emissions by 80% by 2050. And so producing a realistic plan for a country is a very mind-sharpening process. You find that you're really grabbing for every lever that's available to you. I didn't start out feeling that I had to advise the government to build new nuclear power stations, but everything we tried without it in the short term was proving to be very difficult. And this is because in the short term you would naturally turn to fossil fuels before the market had got the other alternative energy sources available. But the real action was when I was sent up to Cumbria to the report back to the government on what should be done with A, the nuclear waste that has been accumulated there, and B, with the uranium and plutonium that has been accumulated through reprocessing. Now, my conclusion was, you have to deal with this hot material before you can put it down into granite below ground. And the way to deal with hot material is to fire neutrons at it and decompose it and turn it into radioactive waste. Now, if you fire neutrons at it, you're making a nuclear power station. You either take electricity out of it or you don't. That's the bit of the no-brainer that I come to. If we don't do that, the alternative is to sell it to the French and let them use it in their nuclear power stations. But in effect, it amounts to much the same thing. If we actually operate our uranium and plutonium as a waste material, the cost to dealing with it was in the 10 to 100 billion pounds. It was a very large sum of money. If we use it as a fuel, on the other hand, in converting it into waste, then we had electricity generation paying for the process. Now, your question about global governance is a much more difficult one, which is why I've been happy to rattle on about the nuclear energy. The global governance issues, I'm simply pointing to the fact that the structure of the Security Council is based around the powers that were in 1945. We need to re-examine the functions of the General Assembly and the Security Council and how we might get better buy-in. For example, the nations of Africa see themselves as only being able to operate really through the General Assembly. And one notion is that there should be always somebody from each major continent on that Security Council in which most major actions are decided. Now, of course, you need to get buy-in from all existing major powers, and so that transition is, I understand, not an easy one, which is why I prefer to say global governance is an issue at the center of our ability to manage these complex issues, and so let's set up a conference in which we're trying to examine how better to enable global governance to occur. And I will give way to experts on global governance at that point.
So I'm going to take these last two, and then I think we're going to have to stop. So short question, shortish answer.
Sure. So To make all of this work and get the governments to interplay with the science and technology in new ways kind of requires a faith in the science. And I wanted to know if you had any kind of a comment or perspective on the unfolding affair that's going on with these climate emails and the suggestion that in this new world where we really do need science and technology to work so closely together, is there a way to assure that the validity of the science is always there so that the policymakers and the public have faith in what we produce?
When I was in the British government, I produced a piece of work on ethics for scientists, and it had three basic principles and 7 points in all. Just 7 points, because I felt that most people can't remember all 10 commandments, and perhaps 7 would be capable of being committed to memory. Rigor, respect, responsibility. Every scientist should be required, in my view, to adhere to a simple set of principles in everything they operate. Now, the first thing I want to say is, and this means I can't say too much, I'm arguing for an inquiry to be made into what happened at the University of East Anglia. I want to know in what way the scientific practices of rigor, respect, and responsibility were or were not broken down. So I'm not going to comment on whether they were or not. I want to know whether the science is affected at all. I do know that the climate skeptics have been given a lot of oxygen by this process. And also, actually, I want to know, and how did the... what lay behind the hacking process? Who was instigating that? So I'm pushing for an inquiry. But let me just quickly say, the key bit of information that they were faced with, the climate scientists, that they didn't like and were trying to leave out of a paper, was information from tree rings in the period from 1970 to 2000. We're back to the big debate around the hockey stick curve. The tree ring data, the latest tree ring data, don't show the big upturn in temperature that has occurred over the last 30 years. But let me say, I'm using those words accurately, there has been a big upturn in temperature over the last 30 years as measured by basic thermometers and by satellites. So we know the temperature rise has occurred, but the tree ring data didn't fit in with that, and so they tried to leave it out. Now, I think the only point I would want to make from this is the reliable piece of data is the thermometer data, and we know from that that we have seen a temperature rise of 0.7 degrees centigrade. I did want to stress in my talk, from paleoclimatology, we already have enough knowledge to understand that this challenge is massive. Alan, I just want to show this because I think the point you're raising is critically important. If I may just go back to that data here, this level of carbon dioxide here is roughly equivalent to this period of time here. So we have already taken the planet back in time to that point about 3 million years ago. In terms of the carbon dioxide levels, it will take 30 years for the temperature rise to catch up with that because of the inertia in the sea level system. So what we can do is just, without any modeling, we can just look back in time and see what it's like when we push greenhouse gas levels up. And, of course, my fear is that we can even get back up there if we burn all of the greenhouse gases, if we burn all of the fuels available to us. So I think the argument is pretty strong. I'm going to stick my neck out on that. But, of course, the scientific community needs to manage the highest standards of rigor in all of its work.
Okay, last question. Please.
Frank Old from GAO. Early on, you talked about the problems in, I think you said, South Australia with drought and salinization. Is there any assistance to deal with that in selection or development of plant varieties that are salt tolerant?
Well, the answer is that if we use genetic modification, we can produce not only flood-resistant crops, as I've indicated with rice, but drought-resistant crops. There are already several varieties that have been produced that have been quite successful, early stages of testing. There are irrigation processes, that is, water being irrigated directly into the plant rather than flooding the entire area that saves water. Saline resistance is also being managed by genetic modification. So each one of these, in addition to disease resistance, can be managed with modern biotechnology techniques. I would also say that in terms of disease resistance, that in time, as a plant is, as the viral components that the plant is defending against change, you can very quickly adapt the plant again with genetic modification. So genetic modification has always the advantage of speed in production over the standard plant breeding techniques.
Good. Well, that was a wonderful talk. Thank you very much, David. Great. Many thanks. And thank you all.
Thank you.